Captain Mullen and Lieutenant Raleigh are waiting for you, sir. Inside, the night clerk waved me toward the desk. Two cops went up to your room. I gave him a $5 bill and put the Lovecraft book and the folders on the counter. Would you hold these things for me? When I walked into my room, Lieutenant Raleigh uncoiled from the side of the bed. Captain Mullen gave me a weary nod. Describe your actions before your visit to headquarters. I realized that Robert had been busy. I drove around, I said. Raleigh thrust his hip against the table. Did your travels take you to Ellendale? I believe they did. About 10:30 p.m., Stuart Hatch turned up in the emergency room at Lawndale Hospital, Mullen said. He claims that he surprised you in an intimate situation with Mrs. Hatch, and you attacked him with a knife. Let's see the knife, Dunstan, Raleigh said. I don't have one, I said. I then told him about going to Ellendale and tussling with a drunken Stuart Hatch. A chainsaw noise came from Raleigh's throat. This guy is all over the place. Mullen clasped his hands in his belly. All in all, Lieutenant Raleigh, I think you can go home for the night. Tell Officer Truehaft he can leave, too. Up to you, Captain. Raleigh slammed the door behind him. Mullen regarded me with an opaque, detached gaze. You're a strange man, Mr. Dunstan. At approximately 9 o'clock p.m., you visited my office for the purpose of informing me that you suspected Earl Sawyer of being the man once known as Edward Reinhardt. At headquarters, you said your mother had given you Reinhardt's name. I had no idea what Robert had said to Mullen, nor did I have a hint of where Mullen was going. Not long before she died, I said, she said Reinhardt was my father. How did you connect Reinhardt with Earl Sawyer? He asked. I told him about Buxton Place and Hugh Coventry's recognizing the owner's names. I described meeting Earl Sawyer, being led into the cottages, seeing the books by Reinhardt and Lovecraft, and finding Sawyer's name in the Dunwich Horror. You were not responsible for the destruction of those books. I realized he was telling me he went to Buxton Place. Mr. Dunstan, I have spent the evening going wherever I thought I might find Earl Sawyer. Edward Reinhardt's coffin at Greenhaven Penitentiary will be disinterred. Maybe we'll find out who's buried in the damn thing. It sure as hell isn't Reinhardt. I don't suppose it can be, I said. On your feet, Mr. Dunstan. You and I are going for a walk. Mullen wheeled into Raspberry. In the darkness, the cobbles descended into a sunken vale, where two policemen leaned against the walls on either side of a door sealed with yellow tape. Take off, Mullen said. The policemen sauntered up the lane. Mullen pulled away strands of tape. He opened the door and the river bottom stench moved out at us like an invisible wall. Mullen went inside and switched on a light. I heard rats scrambling for cover. The door opened into a low-ceilinged room about 12 feet square that looked as though a bomb had gone off inside it. It was the ultimate residence of Cordwainer Hatch. Heaps of refuse, some waist-high, undulated over the floor. Newspapers crisped against the walls like dried seafoam. Earl Sawyer's living room and bedroom, Mullen said. Before we go in the kitchen, look in the closet. He waded through debris and tugged open a door. The shirt and trousers of Sawyer's uniform hung beside a tan windbreaker and a pair of khaki pants. Look on that shelf. I stepped over spongy detritus, went up onto the balls of my feet, and saw a row of knives. Kitchen knives. Knives with stag handles and wooden handles. Knives that folded into black metal hand grips. And knives with blades that flicked out of molded steel cases. Look closer, Mullen said. I leaned forward and saw rusty stains and dried palm prints. Earl liked knives, but he didn't care about cleaning his tools. Fortunately, Earl kept souvenirs. Mullen picked up a bent metal rod that had once been part of an umbrella and pried open the flaps on top of a carton. I peered in at a jumble of wristwatches, bracelets, mismatched earrings, and old wallets scattered with small white bones and the curving fragment of a human skull to which adhered a nugget of gristle. Mullen tapped the fragment with the umbrella rod. I wouldn't be astonished if this used to be part of a gentleman named Minor Keys. Remember him? How could I forget? It was the first time I was ever accused of murder. See these little bones? My guess is they're what's left of the hands cut off a newborn baby we found on top of a dumpster about 4 years ago. Mullen stepped carefully around me. Come into the kitchen. Like a clearing in a forest, a rectangular section of the table at the left of the kitchen stood apart from the mess rising up around it. At the center of the clearing, a black, gold-trimmed fountain pen lay parallel to the edge of a bound journal. Above the rubble at the far end of the table hung a photograph in a silver frame. Crayons and a gold marker had overlaid the image within the frame. I took in what my father had done to a formal portrait of the Hatches. Hand-drawn knives and arrows bristled like quills from Carpenter and Alan Hatch. Their eyes had been inked out and vampire smiles erased their mouths. Swirls of black crayon eradicated small Cobden Hatch. A golden crown broadcast vibrating rays from the head of young Cordwainer, and a golden heart flamed at the center of his chest. Mullen said, "Tell me the name of the kid wearing the crown." "Earl Sawyer." "Edward Reinhardt." "Congratulations, Mr. Dunstan. Your father and Stuart's father were brothers, which makes you and Stuart first cousins." "I guess Earl wasn't too fond of his family," I said. "Here we are, Mr. Dunstan, you and me. Lieutenant Rowley is working the phone, shoring up his walls, doing his best to bribe or threaten himself above flood level. But Rowley can't touch what we do in this room. Do you understand that?" "What does Rowley know about Earl Sawyer?" Another wintry smile. "He knows that Earl has been going around murdering people for the past 30 years. The exciting little twist that Earl Sawyer happens to be long-lost Cordwainer Hatch has not yet come to his attention." "And we are supposed to hide that?" "We can't keep that from coming out. All I want to do is hold the publicity to a minimum and walk away with my reputation and my pension intact. If you're willing to help me see what's going on, maybe we can salvage something out of this mess. I take it that Cordwainer is dead." I did not answer. "Mr. Dunstan, if you tell me you killed him with your own hands, I wouldn't consider bringing charges against you. Cordwainer Hatch is dead," I said. "You could do us both some good by telling me where to find his body." "Nobody is ever going to find his body," I said. "The next time the river floods, his body's not going to wash up on a sandbar. Nothing like that will ever happen." "Did you kill him?" "You'd have to say he killed himself. Mr. Dunstan, the minute Stuart Hatch laid eyes on you, he tried to get you arrested or run out of town. But he never had any idea who Earl was, did he? He thought Cordwainer was dead. And Cordwainer didn't know either. But I have an idea of what he thought he was. Turn around and open that journal, or whatever you call it." I swung around and put my hands on the journal. My fingers turned a thick wad of pages. Cordwainer Hatch's calligraphic handwriting declared in irate black capitals, "I hate art. Art never did anyone a bit of good." And on an earlier page, "Great ones, you with whom this drudge shares a common ancestry. Should you exist at all, I humbly request a degree of recognition commensurate to my service." Then I turned to the last words he had written. I set down the pen and closed the book. The triumph hastens, my heartless fathers. I closed the journal. "What are you going to do with this?" "That's an excellent question. Cordwainer Hatch thought he came from a race of alien monsters who put him here to set up their takeover. He claimed he could transport himself through space, and to lock rooms and make himself invisible. What happens if that goes public? The whole town turns into the National Enquirer. The chief is out, and I'm out, spending the rest of my life running from people who want to write books about the Edgerton monster. Won't you need this as evidence? That cardboard box has all the evidence I'll ever need. But do you have a twin brother, Mr. Dunstan? He claims this brother of yours killed Minor Keys. I have a brother. He isn't really a human being. I didn't know he existed until he showed himself in that lane. That's as far as I want to go, Mr. Dunstan. The position of the Edgerton Police Department is that your father, Cordwainer Hatch, committed his crime out of rage at his family's rejection. A witness currently under police protection has established to our satisfaction that Cordwainer Hatch, alias Edward Reinhardt, alias Earl Sawyer, died in the course of a struggle and that his body can never be recovered. Remember what I say, because you'll have to repeat it about 100 times. When I'd learned my lines, Mullen opened the back door. Come along, Mr. Dunstan. He plunged up the tiny lane, swerving with its abrupt shifts of directions. Do you know what this thing is called? Horsehair? Do you know why? Because it's so narrow, I suppose? Mullen turned into a lane twice the width of Horsehair. The wider lane extended 20 feet to the right and met a brick wall. This is where Horsehair came to an end. I looked at the wall and saw the word Knacker. Do you know what Knackers used to do? I did not. He waved to the building. Its wide double doors were inset with windows, like the old stable doors on Buxton Place. Mullen lowered his shoulder and pushed one of them sideways, and the entire structure trembled. We went into a long, wide space where hooks glinted from listing walls. In the center of the hard-packed earthen floor was a sunken circle about 6 feet in diameter. Mullen moved toward the pit. 100 years ago, they led old horses through that lane and brought them here. The double doors were supposed to remind them of their stables. Most places, knackers slaughtered worn-out horses and rendered their hooves in the glue. Here in Edgerton, they sheared the tails and manes and sold them to wig makers and mattress companies. When a horse came inside, the boomer, that's what they called him, hit it in the head with a sledgehammer. The horse dropped, and the guy they called the hoist picked it up with that thing. He pointed to a long, half-rotted sling suspended from the ceiling. The shearers harvested the hair, and the hoist lowered the carcass onto a hook. When the time came, he raised it up again, swung it over the pit, and lowered it in. The pit disposed of the carcass. How deep is it? Deep enough. On busy days, the knackers dropped 10, 12 horses down there, and none of them ever came back up. What's in there, acid? Mullen picked up a broken cobblestone and tossed it toward the pit. When the cobble fell to within 2 or 3 inches of the surface, I thought I saw the liquid ripple upward to engulf it. In seconds, the cobble became a spinning wafer, a crust, a speck. That is what acid wants to be when it grows up. Anyhow, this is where Earl Sawyer wound up. He took you here, he pushed open the door, you went in behind him, and he pulled a knife. You struggled. Without knowing what was going to happen, you pushed him into the knacker. Goodbye, Earl. No one's going to waste any time looking for his corpse. Mullen led me back to Sawyer's house and told me to take the journal. I never saw it. From here on, it never existed. What now? We're going back to the Brazen Head for the pictures. Then I'm taking you to headquarters, where you will be questioned until dawn, probably. Can you remember your lines? I think so. I'd better call C. Clayton Creech. At police headquarters, shortly before sunrise, I was declared a protected informant and led to a cell. The clanging of the door woke me up at 7:30 a.m. C. Clayton Creech glided in. Mr. Dunstan, we may take a primitive comfort in a development. Mr. Stuart Hatch does not dispute your claim to be the illegitimate son of his uncle Cordwainer. Apparently, the photographs he supplied to our law enforcement officers offer striking corroboration to the claim. In the light of Mrs. Hatch's failure to support him in his time of trial, Stuart no longer wishes to impede your claim to the inheritance of his family's trust. My claim? And Mr. Creech, if Stewart is convicted of a crime, the trust goes to Cobby. Creech's patience was sublime. The state of affairs is this. If you were out of the way, if, for example, you were to remain ignorant of your parentage, Cobden Carpenter Hatch would inherit his family's trust. That is correct. As things stand, however, it must rightfully go to you. Cordwainer was the first child of his generation. You were his son. The trust was yours. Illegitimacy has no bearing on the conditions as written. How much money are we talking about? The current value is at 20 to 25 million, conservatively. Mr. Gillespie, the attorney for the Hatch estate, will be in touch with you today. In the meantime, I'll prepare the documents necessary to sever Gillespie's relationship to the trust and FedEx them to you in New York. Mr. Creech, you're my hero. And since I have more experience of your temperament than Mr. Gillespie, let me ask how much of the windfall you intend to give away. I want to take care of Cobby Hatch. He gets half of the money. I recommend that you establish a trust similar to the Hatches, which would grant the boy a certain sum each year, along with a separate sum for his mother's living expenses. Let's do it. Give Mrs. Hatch $250,000 a year in expenses. And would you please send Mrs. Hatch a letter outlining the terms we've discussed? Of course. A quarter of an hour later, an officer escorted us to the lobby. We emerged into an overcast morning 20 degrees cooler than the day before. Wisps of fog meandered across town square. Thank you, Mr. Creech, I said, and discovered that he was gone. Through coiling fog, I went up the lanes, dove, leather, mutton, treacle, wax, with each step anticipating the footfall, the low smear of laughter that would announce Robert's presence behind me. The threat posed by the being I had known as Mr. X had been forever eradicated. I had done that. I had carried it off. I wanted to tell him that I had given away half of the fortune he had schemed to get. Each of us had saved the other's life. We were finished. It was over. I crossed Veal Yard and went into the lobby and saw Laurie Hatch floating out of a leather armchair. Thank goodness, Ned. Last night the world turned upside down and everything went flying. Then the police barged in and asked all these questions. They even asked about the pictures. Did they talk to you? They talked to me all night long. And let you go. You're not in trouble. I'm fine. I held her hand as we went up the stairs. When I pushed the door shut behind us, Laurie brought her entire body into contact with mine. How long have you known, Laurie? Did you know who I was the first time you saw me? She moved a few inches away. How could I? Ned, don't make both of us unhappy. I took her hand in mine and kissed it. I'm just looking for explanations. Honey, Stuart's going to ruin as many people as he can. He's going to smash up everything he can. Like the Hatch Trust, I said. I told her some of what Creech had said. I never heard very much about Cordwainer, Laurie said. Wasn't he arrested for something ages and ages ago? The part about arrests and convictions doesn't apply to Cordwainer. Cobden Hatch added it in the late 60s. I hardly know what to say. There isn't any doubt. Stuart knew what he was doing. Was any of this on your mind when we talked about you moving to New York? Her composure saw her through a long moment of silence. That was nasty. I couldn't blame you for wanting Cobby to get what he was always supposed to have. He should get it, don't you agree? 24 hours ago, you had no idea that Stuart's uncle was your biological father. Cordwainer didn't want to inherit the trust. He wasn't even a real Hatch. Legally, he was. But you, Ned Dunstan, you're not that kind of person. You're not like Stuart. I want us to have a life together in New York. But Cobby's right to the trust is more valid than yours. You see that, don't you? What I see doesn't make any difference. According to the law, Cobby has no right to it at all. Then I told her about the division of the money and the new trust to be set up for her son. She shook her head. Creech doesn't understand New York. The kind of apartment I'm going to need costs about $2 million. How much do you need to be set for life? 3 million? 5? The rest could be made over to Kavi, with the provision that I have something between 5 and 800,000 a year. We could be together. If we got married, it would be as though you never gave anything up. Would you want a prenuptial agreement? Lori leaned back and regarded me in a steady, unflinching manner. I hate the whole idea of prenups. What a way to begin a marriage. Philadelphia might be good for us. It's less expensive than Manhattan. Her next words clarified whom she had included in us. You'd visit Philadelphia, wouldn't you? Better tell Posey to apply to Temple or UPenn. I can always find another Posey. The hard part was finding one in Edgerton. She kissed my cheek. Call me before you leave. I need your address and phone number. I watched her saunter across the hallway to the staircase. Wisps of fog drifted across the Yule Yard. All at once, grief spoke from every gleaming cobble and wisp of fog, and the world seemed to deepen and enlarge. Grief, I thought. It's everywhere. How could I have supposed I would ever get away from loss? Robert's face vanished backward into a lane. Robert, I have to... On the way to Cherry Street, I kept glancing over my shoulder to find him sprawled across the back seat, but I was still the only person in the car when I pulled up in front of Aunt Nettie's house. It was a little past 9 a.m. All three of my favorite relatives would be in the kitchen. Aunt Nettie and May bustled around the stove. Clark Rutledge sneered up at me.
Good to see you wearing that pretty jacket, boy. They say on the radio Grenville Milton killed himself last night. Care to hear my opinion?
I sat down next to Clark. Fill me in.
Stuart Hatch has enemies who would stop at nothing to put him in a bad light. Left Mr. Hatch holding the bag.
And him with a wife and child, Aunt May said.
His wife and child are going to get 10 or 12 million from a family trust, I said.
Oh, they will have a roof over their heads, May said. I am comforted.
I'm comforted to know you'll have a roof over yours. When Stuart Hatch heard about Milton's suicide, he told his family lawyer all about his Uncle Cordwainer, so you won't have to worry about that anymore. May sank back in her chair and gazed heavenward.
That is a great relief.
Mr. Hatch has released us from our vow of silence, Aunt Nettie said. It seems we have the boy to thank for that.
I second the motion, Clark said, although I regret that Mr. Hatch is bound for the clink.
Stuart Hatch laid out a lot of money to keep you from talking about his uncle, which is why you couldn't tell me about Edward Reinhardt.
Well, son, said Aunt Nettie, we couldn't help but know a lot more about Mr. Edward Reinhardt than your mother ever did.
Because he looked like your father Howard, I said.
You could not miss the resemblance, said May.
So you had a talk with Stuart Hatch.
For the purpose of presenting him with a real estate opportunity, Clark said.
And one of the terms of your agreement was never to divulge what you knew about Edward Reinhardt. How much did you squeeze out of that crook? For once, Clark's smile bore no resemblance to a sneer.
A handsome sum.
Now it's my turn to make a confession, I said. I had to borrow those photographs Aunt Nettie was storing in her closet.
Isn't that interesting, May said. I have to say I never did understand why Mrs. Hatch asked me to magpie them out of the library. I liked her little boy.
Me too, I said. I'll go out and get the photographs, and then I want to drop in on Joy. I'm going back to New York later today. Clark gave me a roguish sneer and pushed himself away from the table.
I'll walk out with you.
On our way down the steps, I asked Clark if he knew if Joy had called Mount Baldwin.
Hasn't been a peep out of Joy in 2 days. Since we got this far, let's check in on her.
Joy did not respond to a knock on her door. Clark opened the door.
Joy, it's me and Nettie, Stars boy. How you been?
When we entered the living room, Clarence goggled at us with a mixture of relief and terror and threw himself against the strap. Clark, call Mount Baldwin and have them send an ambulance right now.
Will do, Clark said. You scout around for joy. I don't like the look of this.
I flipped the light switch at the bottom of the stairs and heard Clark summoning the ambulance for Mount Baldwin. Above me, a dull thump came from the attic. Some heavy object had been brought into contact with the side of a wooden crate. What came to mind was a softball the size of a pumpkin. By the time I got to the top of the stairs, the big softball again thumped the side of the crate. I opened the attic door and saw a pair of black running shoes with their toes on the pine boards. Extending from the tops of the shoes, two thin legs disappeared beneath a black hem. I moved up beside Joy's body. A tray, a spoon, an inverted bowl, and the dried remains of chicken noodle soup lay beyond her outstretched arms. Her skin was cold. A small bed enclosed within a box-like wooden frame butted against the wall at the far side of the attic. A cot covered with an army surplus blanket stood along the wall at a right angle to the enclosed bed. Whatever was inside the bed struck the side of the frame. I remembered the names on the stone slabs behind the ruins on New Providence Road. What had held Joy prisoner had not been a phobia. She and Clarence had been captive to a merciless responsibility. I walked past Joy's outstretched arms and the spray of noodles. When I came up to the foot of the bed, a nearly solid cloud of river bottom stench soaked into me. Lying on the mattress at the bottom of the wooden frame was a being made up of a filmy, insubstantial body glowing with light, and the face of a man with a graying bush of hair and Confucian white tendrils of beard. His ecstatic brown eyes were already widening in shock. The layers of color sifting through the limbless rectangle of his body darkened from robin's egg blue and ripe peach to a violent purple in which swirls of black bloomed like ink. The creature fixed me with a monstrous demand, shuddered sideways, and slammed its head against the side of the pen. I went to the cot, pulled the pillow from beneath the army blanket, and pressed it down upon the terrible face. The thing struggled and surged against the pillow. Its jaw opened and closed as its teeth sought my hands. Bands of brilliant red rose to the surface of its body. Then the jaw stopped working, and the color faded. A pure, depthless black swam up over the filmy surface of the little body and faded to a lifeless gray. I watched my hands tear the pillow out of the pillowcase and fling it onto the cot. My right hand dipped into the pen, closed on a wispy rope of beard, and lifted the thing I had murdered. A limp, ragged substance like old spider webs drooped from beneath the beard. I rammed it into the pillowcase and stumbled down the stairs. Clark was standing in the hallway.
"Did you locate Joy?"
"I think she had a heart attack. She's dead. I'm sorry, Clark. We have to call the police, but before you do that, I need a little time." Clark's eyes moved to the pillowcase.
"I guess little Mousy starved to death."
"You knew about him?"
"Speaking personally, I never saw the boy. Queenie and my wife assisted at the birth. Clarence and Joy, that child took over their lives."
"They couldn't have named it Mousy," I said, and remembered the names in the flat granite stones on New Providence Road.
"Never really named it at all," Clark said. "Joy took pride in the command of the French language, you know. The way I heard it, Queenie burst into tears when the baby came out. Joy said, 'I want to see it.' And when Nettie held that baby up, Joy said, 'Mousy.' That means me too in the French language. She blamed Howard for the way her baby came out, and she never forgave him. So we called the baby Mousy, which pretty soon it turned into Mousy."
"Would you care to say farewell to Mousy?"
"The shovel is out behind the kitchen," Clark said.
The shortest and grimmest of the three funerals I attended during my stay in Edgerton took place in Joy's backyard. While I was digging, I heard Clark haranguing the ambulance attendants from Mount Baldwin who were taking away Clarence.
"Mousy," I said, "not that it matters to you, but I'm sorry. You had a terrible life. If you happen to come around again, things almost have to be better. But if you want my advice, stay where you are."
I pitched the shovel into the weeds and came back into the house. Clark called 911. 10 minutes later, two baby cops piled out of a squad car and jogged to the door. I said that I had found the deceased. It looks to me like she had a heart attack while bringing lunch up to her husband. In the attic, the cop stared down into Mousy's crib. If I come down with Alzheimer's, I hope my wife won't dump me into a plywood crib, said one of the cops. Downstairs, Clark excused himself to tell his wife what had happened. The medical examiner arrived, went in the house, and Aunt Nettie came over to me.
You did the right thing, son.
I hope so.
My sister's child claimed her energies from the moment the poor thing first drew breath. Joy sends you blessings for giving Mousy a decent burial. I hope you'll be coming back to see us on a regular basis.
Should I stick around for another day or two?
I'm thankful you could spend so much time with us, and you rescued our pictures. It takes a great weight off my mind, Nettie. Make your travel arrangements, and be sure to keep in touch.
Take care, Clark said. There's not but a few of us left. Now Mousy's in his grave.
The sky had disappeared above Cherry Street. A wet, silvery mist coated my windshield. Back in my room, I charged a seat on a 6 p.m. flight from St. Louis to New York, first class. According to C. Clayton Creech, I had at least $10 million. My companions in first class were going to love my pink jacket. And they give you an extra bag of pretzels up there at the front of the plane. A few ghost-like relics wandered through the fog thickening on Word Street. I threw my bags under the back seat and got behind the wheel. At Chester Street, I turned north, thinking that eventually I would see a sign to a bridge across the Mississippi and the highway to St. Louis. Before I reached College Park, the buildings on either side had retreated into vague backdrops, and the headlights of oncoming cars were like cat's eyes. I remembered Mousy's teeth rising into the pillow, and I saw inky flack bursting within the bands of deep red glowing across his abbreviated body, the dirty spider web that body had become, the bowling ball weight of his head in the pillowcase. Clark had told me that I was turning into a real Dunstan, but I was nothing compared to Mousy. Mousy was up there with Brightness and Screamer. What leaked from the cannon's mouth and the crack in the golden bowl was a being like Mousy. Howard had known it, and the knowledge had poisoned him. I could not see where I was, and I could not tell where I was going. Looking for a familiar name, I bent over the wheel and peered through the windshield. The fog would lift. Even if it did not, eventually I would drive into clear air. As long as I kept moving, I was making progress. The fog drew in to erase the houses. Half an hour later, I drove into a gleaming mist widening out over open fields on both sides of the road. It gathered itself into a melting darkness and forced me down to 5 miles an hour. Then I slammed my foot on the brake pedal. The blue plastic of the steering wheel seemed to be rising through my hands as they faded from view. I felt a tingle at the back of my neck and became aware of a presence behind me. I shouted Robert's name and twisted my head to look at the empty back seat. Robert, where are you? I held up my hands and saw them restored and solid. I have to talk to you. I have to know what you want from me. He wants everything, I thought. I wrapped my fingers around the door handle and pushed myself off the seat. At the front of the car, the headlights picked out the shadowy pole of a road sign. Robert hovered beside me, behind, I could not tell which. Show yourself. You owe me that much. Robert thought he owed me nothing. Robert was like Mousy. He had leaked from the crack in the golden bowl. He had trickled from the mouth of the cannon. Moi aussi. I went up to the shadowy road sign and laughed out loud. I had come back to New Providence Road. This is where we are, Robert. Do your best. A hesitant footfall, then another, sounded from behind me. Footsteps ticked through the shining fog. I did the one thing my furious double could not, and slid 35 years down my gullet. On the 17th day of October in the year 1958, I was standing at the rear of a densely crowded Albertus University auditorium. I was at a concert. Looking down over the audience, I went toward the top of the wide central aisle. I caught sight of my mother's dark, unmistakable head. There she was, the 18-year-old Star Dunstan, seated 10 or 12 rows back from the stage. The man sitting next to my mother had a profile that looked too much like mine. The piano player turned to the audience. "We'd like to do a ballad called These Foolish Things." The saxophonist pushed himself off the piano, approached a microphone at the front of the stage, and settled his fingers on the keys. Then he floated above the line of the song and blew a liquid phrase that said, "You know the song, but do you know this story?" Star's head snapped up. Listening without hearing, Edward Reinhardt lounged in his seat and concealed his disdain. Star shifted in her seat, opened her mouth, and leaned forward. I felt tears slide down my cheek. "It was like hearing the whole world open up in front of me." He kept moving deeper and deeper into that melody until it opened up like a flower and spilled out 100 other melodies that got richer and richer. That alto player never moved anything but his fingers. His mouth looked like a flexible sea creature. Note after note, the tremendous story in all of its details soared into the reaches of the auditorium. It seemed like the long unfolding of a landscape seen from the top of a mountain. In another time, my own, fog swarmed across a road where two sets of footsteps advanced toward whatever was to come. I put my shoulders against the wall and listened for as long as I could. The whole world opened up in front of me. What? Oh, you want to know what happened to Robert? I'm sorry, that has already been answered. Answered as well as it can be, anyhow. Step after step, along the pavements of every city I inhabit for a week or two in my endless flight, the ticking of Robert's footsteps sounds in my awaiting ear. But since you have put a question to me, I can ask one in return. Are you sure? Really sure? You know who told you this story?